issues. And we have guests tonight. Let's have a look at how many guests do we have here tonight. Okay, now, so why don't I just, somebody would raise their hand, they brought a guest, and we can just have them introduce them. That would be great. So we have someone back here. Carrie brought someone.
Elena Nichols is here again to join us. She's a estate planning attorney and working in Portland, but
Washington.
Yeah. With Gebertz Menashe, just new with Gebertz Menashe.
Oh, yeah. Right, they have the estate planning section. Who else brought guests? Okay, we have one here. Thank you, Linda.
Hi, I brought Tony Schmidt, who is another co-worker of mine, who's a CFP and maybe working at Chinese on the road here.
Great. Anyone else bring a guest here? Oh, I brought a guest. You gotta laugh. Okay, this is David. Is it Rutan? He's with Waddell and Reed here in Vancouver. His office is in Cascade Park. So glad to have you here. Okay, Marcine.
And Mr. Teague, who's going to stand up here so you can all see him again, is coming back for a second session of looking at you, deciding whether he's going to join you or not. So be sure and introduce yourself to him and encourage him to come join us.
Thank you, Marcine. Anyone else? Nope. Just make sure you do sign in and put your card in that. Okay, was there anything else we needed? Okay, great. Okay, so we are going to have a presentation from Carol Vanetta. She is the executive director of the Peace Health Foundation, and she's going to tell us about Peace Health and the foundation, and obviously, hopefully, educate us more about this important institution in our community here. So I'm going to turn it over to her now. Here we go. And remember, we're going to do the drawing after Carol's done. Here we go. Yeah, you'll need. Hold on, I guess.
Okay. Well, welcome, everyone. We're just so delighted that you were able to join us here at Peace Health Southwest tonight. As Barb said, I'm Carol Vanetta. I'm the executive director of the Peace Health Southwest Foundation. I've been a fundraiser now for about 35 years. I know, I look like just a baby, but I've been doing this for 35 years, and I've been here at Peace Health for the last 15 months. And when I came to Peace Health, one of the things, I had never worked in a religious institution. I'd always worked in secular institutions. So I wondered, what was this going to be like working in a religious institution? And one of the things that I learned was that before any kind of meeting or gathering at Peace Health, someone always does a reflection. And a reflection, of course, is a way of centering ourselves and thinking about, you know, what we're going to be talking about and what we're going to be doing and just kind of getting a little in tune with the spiritual side. So I'm going to do a little reflection for you tonight. And this is called A Prayer Among Friends. And it's by a Northwest poet named John Daniel. So here it is, A Prayer Among Friends. Among other wonders of our lives, we are alive with one another. We walk here in the light of this unlikely world that isn't ours for long. May we spend generously the time we are given. May we enact our responsibilities as thoroughly as we enjoy our pleasures. May we see with clarity. May we seek a vision that serves all beings. May we honor the mystery surpassing our sight. And may we hold in our hands the gift of good work and bear it forth whole as we were born forth by a power we praise to this one earth, this homeland of all we love. Okay, so there it is, A Prayer Among Friends. Okay, but on to Peace Health Southwest. And my good assistant, Allison, is going to help me here. So we are ready to go. This is the Furstenberg Tower. But our story begins in 1858 when Sister Joseph, who later was given the title of Mother Joseph, opened St. Joseph's Hospital, the very first hospital in the Northwest. There is a sketch of it, a tiny room with four beds, benches, a table, carved by Sister Joseph. Do you know that she is also the Northwest's first architect and that she actually designed the Academy building and built much of it herself. Isn't that amazing? Her father was a carpenter in Montreal, and he taught her his trade. She was a very talented and skilled and brave woman. This is the oldest continuously operating hospital in the Pacific Northwest. There they are. Aren't they a good-looking bunch? All right. So one of the things that we always like to say here at Peace Health is that philanthropy has been with us since day one. Matter of fact, there was a priest who worked closely here at Fort Vancouver with Mother Joseph, and one day he was walking along from where he lived to where the nuns lived, and he looked down and there was a little coin on the ground, and he picked this coin up, and the story is that he handed this coin to Mother Joseph and said, "Here is your first donation to the hospital." So very sweet. And the ladies were fearless in terms of their fundraising for the hospital. All right, Al. Well, here we are today. And man, what a time to be in healthcare, right? Can you see some of the things that are going on here? We have the Affordable Care Act, a huge expansion of the Medicaid services. We have physician shortages. We have the whole move to electronic health records. We have declining federal reimbursements. And we have all sorts of new things entering the market, you know, Zoom care and urgent cares and a lot of different things. So it is a very volatile time in the healthcare market, and all of us are sort of gingerly feeling our way through to the future. So Peace Health today, an important part of our community. And here are some of our facilities. Peace Health Columbia Center, that's on 192nd. That's our corporate headquarters. We have family medicine in Battleground. We have family medicine at Fisher's Landing. We have, of course, the medical center. We have the Ray Hickey Hospice House. And then we have the, remember, Memorial Hospital is still a part of Peace Health too. So that's Peace Health Southwest at the Memorial Campus. So something that people can kind of lose sight of, because when you've been in a community for a long time, people kind of take you for granted and they kind of forget about you, but we are the largest employer in Clark County. And there it is, there are the numbers for the six largest employers. So we're an important part of this community, not only as a healthcare provider, but also as an employer. And I don't know about you, but like on my block, in one block, there are three people that work for Peace Health. We've got a physician, a technician, and myself all on one block. So we're all over the county. Some other things about Peace Health. Huge emergency department. We have one of the largest ERs in the state of Washington. In fact, only Harborview Hospital in Seattle sees more emergency room visits than we do. About 2,600 babies born here every year. We have almost 25,000 inpatient admissions every year. Over 3,000 employees, 600 medical staff, and then 235,000 outpatient clinic visits. So we're a busy place. What makes a great healthcare provider? Here are some of the things we offer. Complete primary care service. We're a level two trauma care. So when you read the Columbian and there's a big, you know, smash up on I-5, and you read the story and the guy was airlifted to where? Peace Health Southwest, right? Yeah, we do a lot of the trauma work in the area. Neurosurgery, we're very strong in the neuro area. Cardiac surgery, we do everything except heart transplants. So very high level of cardiac services. We do orthopedics, you know, Rebound is associated with us, and they're a really excellent physician group. We do things like robotic surgery. A lot of very cutting-edge techniques are used here. And then, of course, we have our high-risk neonatal intensive care unit, too, which is the Holtzman Twins NICU. So we've got a full range of services here at Peace Health Southwest. We're growing. We're continuing to improve and expand our services, our heart and vascular services. We're in December, we'll open our new hybrid cath lab, which will be a state-of-the-art catheterization lab. It'll allow our physicians, if there's a problem with a catheterization, to go into open heart surgery immediately without changing operating rooms or anything changing, which is great. We'll talk a little later about the expansion of neurosciences, and then we're also engaging in new oncology collaborations. I don't know if you're aware of this, but oncology is sort of all over the place in Clark County. And we want to start working more collaboratively, both with the nonprofit and for-profit oncology service providers in the community. So in terms of community service, we contribute more than $136 million each year in community benefits. How do we do that? Through our community outreach, you know, programs. I don't know if you saw in the paper recently, free breast cancer screenings during October, Women's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. We have a residency program. Our family medicine clinic over at Memorial, staffed entirely by UW residents, physicians in training. We do all sorts of health education. We engage in research, and we subsidize a lot of programs, and we do a heck of a lot of charity care. Last year, we provided about $45 million in charity care. And that's part of the mission that the sisters started right at the beginning. They were going to care for the poor and the vulnerable, and we have carried that mission right through to this day. So, as we said earlier, from our first days, the philanthropy of the community has allowed us to exist and to flourish. And in that period, from 2005 through June 30th of 2014, Peace Health Southwest received about $71 million in contributions. Some of the things that those private contributions have made possible include our Furstenberg Tower, our Holtzman Twins Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, the Kearney Breast Center, which, by the way, is celebrating its fifth anniversary on October 21st. You're all invited. We're going to have a wonderful guest speaker from OHSU, Mike McNabb's organization. Dr. Lisa Cousins, she's one of the world's leading breast cancer researchers, and she's going to be right here in this auditorium. And then most recently, you may have read in the paper about the gift from Thomas and Sandra Young, and that gift is going to name our new neurosciences inpatient unit. Okay, you guys, what's neurosciences? Bill?
It's the science of the brain and the nerves and things of that nature.
Very good. Very, very good. The brain and the spine and the related, yeah, that's neurosciences. How important is your brain, Bill?
Pretty.
Pretty darn important, right? Okay. Onward. So the campaign for neurosciences we're undertaking right now. So the first part of that is, you know how you have a maternity ward, you have a cancer ward, you have a heart ward, right? Well, our neuroscience patients have been distributed throughout the hospital population. We haven't had a specific neurointensive care unit. We are now getting one. It will be the sixth floor of the Furstenberg Tower. So if you have a stroke, if your mother or father has a stroke, if you're in a car accident, if you've had any kind of trauma to your brain, you're going to get the highest possible level of neuro care on this floor. Our goal was to raise $3 million to redo that floor, and we're less than $100,000 from our goal. If anyone would like to write me a check tonight, and we can just check that one off our list, but we're getting close to our goal there. Phase two, one of the things that when you have any kind of a neuro condition, you want the people that care for you, including the nurses, the physical therapists, the occupational therapists, you want them trained to the very highest level possible. We're talking about your brain. So this endowment is going to create a perpetual education fund for our nurses in this area so that they'll always have the very finest training in this area. So we're working on that too. And then finally, the last part of our campaign is going to be expanding and refurbishing the rehabilitation unit, which is here in the old Mother Joseph building. You know, we have the old and the new being Furstenberg, the old being this wing. And so if you've had an injury to your brain, probably you're going to need some kind of rehabilitation. And the best place to get rehabilitation is actually in a hospital setting rather than in a nursing home or a care setting. you'll get a higher quality and more intensive kind of care. So we need to completely refurbish our neuro inpatient unit, and we're going to raise $6 million to do that. So that's what we're doing right this instant. We'd love your help with that. If you know people that have experienced stroke or any kind of brain trauma, or their family members have, think of this project. Anything else, Allison? Is that it? So one more really important thing, and that is that the president of our foundation board, we have a 24-member foundation board, and the president of our board is here with us tonight, George Middleton, right there. And we are so lucky to have George as our president, because we keep him really busy. And he's just always so gracious with his time and has been such a wonderful supporter. So we're really thrilled to have George as the president of our board. So, does anybody have any questions before we go on to our main presentation? Oh, we're going to have a drawing. Everybody put the, okay. All right, Sherry, what are we drawing for here?
We're drawing for a couple gifts.
We have several gifts. Let's see, who's going to get what?
Go ahead.
The suspense, the suspense. Jill Kurtz? Yay. Jill. All right. Oh. Jill gets a Peace Health Stadium blanket.
Nice.
How's that? All right. What else? Let's do another one. Sid Bowles. Sid, all right. They're right here. Now, there's a little something in that Peace Health cup for you, Sid. You might want to open it and see what's in there. Yeah. All right, we got two more. Mike Day. Hi. Right, a free colonoscopy. Oh. There's another stadium. All right, and we have one more. Let's see who the lucky person is here. All right, David Rutan. Right here, David. All right. And there's something in that cup for you, David. Are you sure? It's got a little. You take it, David. Go ahead and take it. No. You need it. Thank you, though. Thank you. Any questions? Does anybody have any burning questions about Peace Health Southwest? Anybody? Yes, sir.
Yeah, my wife is very concerned about all the news about Ebola. She has seen on TV it could be bankrupting the entire hospital system. How has Peace Health addressed it?
Funny you should ask. I was just in a meeting this morning about Ebola, and you know, the CDC is working very closely with all the hospitals across the country, and they're sending us protocols and telling us, you know, what we're supposed to do and what have you, and people are taking it extremely seriously. But the last I read on it just this afternoon was that they may actually designate certain hospitals in the various regions of the country as kind of our Ebola expert centers. So if we got a patient, say, here at Peace Health who presented with those symptoms, they might actually end up going somewhere else where they'd have really superior intensive care for that person. So yeah, it's a big deal. And we have our today, tomorrow, and the next day, we have medical examiners here. You know, the people that drop in on hospitals from time to time to check up on you and make sure that you're doing the right things. And one of the things they're checking on is, are we Ebola ready? Any other questions from anyone? How many of you have actually been in this hospital, been a patient here, or had? Great. Well, thank you. I hope you had a good experience. With that, all right, Barb. Thank you, folks, for your time.
Okay, I just wanted to also mention, oh, there it goes, okay, our next meeting, we talked about that, we're going to have a last meeting at the end of the year. Bob talked about that last time. It might be like a montage of Hollywood estate planning issues. but it'll be an annual meeting and, of course, some social time, too. That would be in May. So just keep your... We're waiting on that one. We wanted like to get CE credits for that. So no further ado. We're going to have Bill Zook is here. He's talking about planned giving. When I was with the American Red Cross, PG Calc was the group that I liaised with for planned giving because they have a wonderful software. And so Bill is a member of the Washington State Bar Association. He started in estate planning for a very short career. And then he ended up working for Planned Giving Services back in, I think, 1996. And that was purchased by PG Calc in 2005. And he's been doing this work for 18 years. So he's got this down. And what he does is he's a charitable giving consultant. He works with directly with the charities, which he did with me when I was at the Red Cross. And he works with their donors. So he's going to talk to us about planned giving tonight. And I believe that he works with Peace Health. Is that correct?
I have in the past.
You have in the past, right. Okay, anyway, here's Bill Zook, PG Calc. Thank you very much for joining us here. You want to take that?
Okay. Is this picking? Nope, it's not picking up.
It's fine.
Oh, it is? Really?
Yeah.
You can hear me okay? All right.
This is
Oh, I see. This one records and one projects. Okay. Yeah, who needs it? I've been introduced, so we'll do that. Thank you very much. Jeez, I've never had so much technology in my hands in my life. This is really exciting here. Oopsie. And look what I've done with it. I've already shot through half of my presentation. Bear with me. I'm going to need another 30 seconds or so. Oops. All right. Thank you, Barb. Thank you, Carol, for hosting us. This is a nice place and good food and things like that. And thank you, everybody, for attending. I think I'm duty-bound to go for an hour, even though we're about 15 minutes behind schedule because of Bar Association and other credit-granting things, but I will try to make it a fast-moving hour, and kind of by definition it will be, because I'm giving a talk that in the past I've given over more like 90 minutes, but it is a quick overview of a lot of the kind of basics of charitable planned giving, and maybe review for some of you, but also I think some things that will quite possibly be new as well. So just a kind of general overview of charitable giving, even though pretty quickly we're going to zero in on some things that have to do more with estate and financial planning, but people who make gifts do it in a variety of ways. Mostly planned giving works with individuals, but charitable gifts can be made by various entities, whether they're businesses, other various types of charitable entities giving to separate types of charitable organizations, all kinds of things. But we are mostly talking about individuals. Gifts can be of various kinds, but we're mostly talking about relatively large ones, and quite often, although not always, ones that are motivated at least in part by tax considerations, or sometimes other financial or estate or life planning considerations. the nature of the recipient. People can be charitable directly to individuals, and those individuals can be near at hand or on the other side of the world. But we're also here talking more about gifts that are to essentially so-called qualified charities, charities that where the gift results in some sort of tax benefit. Quite often, in addition to the donor and the one or more organizations that he or she wants to support, there are a cast of characters, and that's pretty much you guys, people in the various allied professions as such. Law, accounting, investments, things of that nature. And so that's part of the context, and I think a very important part for you as well. And also, planned giving is mostly a fairly set type of number of vehicles, the types of vehicles, the rules that govern them. There are developments occasionally, just as there are in the law every year with respect to any kind of aspect of the law, as well as to the surrounding economy and things like that. But mostly we're dealing with things that are fairly tried and true, timeless, but also there is some benefit to being mindful of what's timely or where the trends are going. So with that understanding, just a couple of terms that you may well have your own definitions of already, but planned giving or gift planning is like it sounds, it's charitable giving, with some sort of planning process that takes into account not only the philanthropic element of the arrangement, but also various things that are going on in the donor's life, whether they're personal, family, financial, tax, whatever. A planned gift is a result, is a gift that results from a gift planning process, basically. But that's it. That term is more a description of how the gift came to be, whereas you might have a term like major gift or something like that, which is more on the size. That being said, planned gifts are generally large and sometimes very large. And planned giving really kind of has one foot in charitable fundraising and another foot in estate planning. It's a good cross between the two. I think a lot of you, because you're in estate planning in one form or another, have your own definition of estate planning, but you know, you want to think broadly. It's more than just what happens to a person when they die and what happens to their stuff and all. A lot of it has to do with the balance of their life, however long that may be. And then there's this notion of legacy planning. I think, again, broadly understood, legacy is the many ways that people do things during and with their lives that carry meaning beyond their lives. But legacy planning has also often come to be understood as a type of charitable planning for the future as well. Now, planned gifts are a good shorthand way to think of them. Apart from definitions, some characteristics are probably helpful. Probably the best is that they're gifts that people make from their assets as opposed to giving that they do from their income, or sort of checkbook giving. It's almost always a group event, at least, as I say, the donor and the charity, but very often as well, any number of people from other disciplines and family members and spiritual advisors and all kinds of people that are part of a proper comprehensive process. Planned gifts are made generally on the donor's sense of timing. It's difficult beyond a point for a charity to create a sense of urgency that can often backfire. And although it's important to make an organization's known interests and issues and needs known and understood, planned gifts happen generally when the time is right for the donor based on things that are going on in their lives. So the wise charity plants seeds, provides information, gives ideas, lets people know that they're available to be part of the planning team or the planning process. But it's not the same as a campaign which has a deadline or so. You can mix in elements of that, but you have to be careful. Planned gifts are made, they're emotional decisions. They're made in the heart, essentially. And the head just kind of helps round out the details. The size of the gift, when it's made, what assets used, how it's structured, things of that nature. A lot of the time, planned gifts are for endowment, but that needn't be the case. There are other possibilities. And also, quite often, planned gifts are deferred. They're arranged now, but they don't come to the organization until later. But as we'll see, there are some exceptions to that, too. Now, there are many different kinds of charitable recipients, and a lot of them, most of them, recipients of planned gifts, are public charities in general, which do anything and everything that's good in our culture and our society. So Peace Health is a public charity, and as our many, many other types of organizations, educational, social, religious, environmental, the arts, you name it. Community foundations are a separate kind of public charity that play a unique role, not only in physical, geographical communities, but otherwise. We'll talk a little bit more about each of these. Supporting organizations are not very common. They're probably somewhat more numerous than community foundations because many of them are related to community foundations. A given community foundation might have four or five or a few dozen supporting organizations that support it. Plus, there are supporting organizations that are created by charities, and those are more common. So you might have a college foundation or a healthcare foundation or something like that that supports an actual facility. There are private operating foundations, which are not very common. They tend to be like museums or gardens or things like that. Sport is private, but they're operated for the good of the public. And then there are the private non-operating foundations, the monsters like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Ford Foundation, but also smaller family or individual foundations, corporate foundations, things of that nature. So all of these can be recipients of various kinds of planned gifts. So again, just talk about the various kinds in a little more detail, many different types of public charities. Gifts to them generally can be restricted or unrestricted. And these are the best kinds of recipients of gifts from a tax standpoint because the nature of the deduction is as high as it can be, particularly for gifts of various kinds of long-term appreciated property, and also the limits of adjusted gross income against which a donor can claim his or her deduction are the most favorable. And public charity status carries over, again, not only with the sort of literal public charities that are out doing this and that, but other things. Community foundations are among these. As I say, they're kind of special public charities. They generally make grants to other public charities. Sometimes the grant making can be done directly to individuals, but there's a lot more that's involved in those kinds of things. Usually a community foundation, certainly a traditional one, will have a geographic focus, and not to draw too much attention to my colleague Mary, who's still getting over jet lag from having been to Europe recently, but Mary can tell you a lot more about community foundations, and if she hasn't been a speaker up here, she should be sometime, because she can educate you about all that the Community Foundation for Southwest Washington does in Clark and the neighboring counties. But many other communities throughout the United States have them. In the state of Indiana, I think every county has a community foundation because the Lilly Foundation is headquartered in Indianapolis, and some decades ago they decided it would be a good idea if every local community, at least in the state of Indiana, had its own community foundation. Some of those, as you might imagine, are rather small. In the state of Washington, there are more or less a couple dozen community foundations. Some are very big, like Seattle and Tacoma and Inland Northwest and Southwest, and others are quite small. But community foundations can also serve, for example, different religious traditions. So there are Jewish federations, there are community foundation-like organizations that are affiliated with many different religious traditions. And you can also have them where they're focused on a type of charitable work or endeavor. So up in Seattle, at least, there's Pride Foundation, which has a focus on gay and lesbian concerns, but also general ones within the community. There's a foundation in the Dakotas, particularly North Dakota, called the Dakota Medical Foundation, which supports the health of the state statewide. And then finally, there are the ones that are perhaps often known as affiliated with financial institutions, such as Fidelity Charitable. Vanguard has a charity associated with and others. But they are nationwide, and they're community foundations in some respects, but not in others as well, because they don't have a base that is mostly charitable. Their base is mostly financial. And there are different kinds of funds that you can have at a community foundation, as we'll see. So they can be unrestricted or at the discretion of the community foundation in terms of what kinds of charities are supported with the distributions, an area of interest, so it could be healthcare or education or alleviation of poverty, general types of charitable activity. They can be designated for one or more particular charities, particularly if it's an endowed fund. It can provide perpetual support to one or more specific organizations over time. And the ever-popular Donor Advised Fund, which, as it sounds, is where a donor helps to establish the fund and then provides advice to the charity, sometimes with regard to the investment of the fund's assets, but more often with regard to distributions from the fund. Supporting organizations they exist, you know, in part to help a supported organization. So they exist in order to, as I say, support a hospital or a college or something like that, or they might support a community foundation or some combination of charitable organizations. There are three basic types. There are ones that are established by donors but are done very closely in terms of their operation with one or more of the charities that they support, so the board of the organization has a majority of charity people. The second type is the one you'll more often find where it's been established by a charity for that charity's benefit, but it's a separate legal entity, And then there's the type 3, which is one where there's a little bit more control and influence that the donor has, but it also comes increasingly with scrutiny by the IRS and by Congress. And so the type 3s are not especially popular. They are, however, they do qualify for public charity status, and if they're done at least with a community foundation, quite often they're paired with a donor-advised fund. Private operating foundations, again, they do some of the things that that public charities do, only a more limited range of activities usually. They aren't publicly supported, but they operate programs for the general public, and they too enjoy public charity status. And then private non-operating foundations. Mostly what they do are make grants to other public charities. Again, sometimes the grants can be directly to individuals or to entities overseas. They are not supported publicly, which is why they're called private foundations, usually a donor or a family or some close, small group of people as opposed to the general public. And because of this, they have generally, under the law, been less favored. The deductions associated with contributions of long-term capital gain property are more limited, and the ability to use those deductions is also more limited. So here's a little bit of a graphic, at least, of a kind of continuum of control. With a public charity, it can, you can have some ability to designate or restrict your gift if you're a donor, but quite often, you get the most control as a donor if you are a donor to a private foundation, and of course the threshold for establishing those is generally fairly high. And then at community foundations, again, you've got different kinds of funds, anywhere from the discretionary to donor-advised funds. Some types of charities other than community foundations do have donor-advised funds, some universities, some healthcare institutions, a few others, but they aren't especially common. So there are two basic kinds of plan gifts, current and deferred. Most plan gifts, I think, are deferred, but there are some current ones, and so we'll talk a bit about those. Basically, outright transfers, where nevertheless, there's some sort of planning process that's going on, and I'll dwell on those in just a minute. There are also charitable bargain sales. Those are not especially common, but in certain cases, they can be just the right thing. And the charitable lead trust, which is also not especially common, but again, under certain donor circumstances and charitable objectives, they're great. Deferred gifts, you see, you have more opportunities, and a lot of them that you may recognize or think of more often as planned giving vehicles. So bequests are really the heart of planned giving. That's where most of the money that organizations raise through planned gifts comes from. They're easily understood. They're traditionally established in our legal system, and so they enjoy a very favored position. But there are a number of other arrangements as you go down the list that essentially involve some sort of combination of benefits where the charity benefits on the tail end and the donor or one or more people will benefit in the shorter term. So in terms of outright gifts, you can certainly make a planned gift with cash. Cash can be an asset. It might be money that a donor has in a money market account or CDs. I mean, I work with people sometimes who have hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash, and it's either because that's a fraction of their wealth or it's a lot of their wealth, and they're just very conservative in how they invest it. But most of the action that you see with planned gifts is with regard to long-term capital assets, particularly publicly traded securities, also some privately held securities, also real estate, and a miscellaneous number of other types of assets. The advantage there is that you, as the donor, get a deduction for the full fair market value of the asset, provided it's been owned at least a year and a day, but you do not get taxed on any of the capital gain. So that advantage can carry over not only from outright gifts, where you see it in its plainest form, but into another set of options with some of the other split benefit gifts as well. And so, you know, even though Carol would be happy to have you guys write a check for her campaign, my advice would be long-term securities. But either one is accepted, right? Right. Okay. Sometimes ordinary income property is used, but not as often because that limits the deduction to the lesser of cost basis or the fair market value of the item. And even less often you see tangible personal property, which is a sort of a kind of ordinary income property in many respects. It has to do with the nature of the property and how that relates to the mission of the charity that's being supported through a gift of that property. So I've structured this where we talk a little bit about each vehicle and then we focus on what might go wrong. And you know, one of the biggest problems is sometimes donors don't know about the tax advantage of giving long-term capital gain assets, so they sell them first and then they want to give the cash. And you tend to find this more in sales of businesses, where it might be a business that the donor started 20 or 25 or 35 years ago and they're selling it. And if there could have been a structure, an element to the overall structure of the sale that included a charitable gift component, then maybe some of that capital gain could have avoided taxation. But you find it in other run-of-the-mill assets as well, like real estate or things like that. Now, of course, if a donor is selling their personal primary residence, principal residence, then there's a large exemption from capital gains tax. So in those kinds of cases, it can make sense for a donor to sell it and then give some or all the resulting cash because there are very high exemptions from capital gains tax. Sometimes short-term capital gain assets are used. Again, the disadvantage is that the deduction is going to be based on the cost basis of those assets rather than their full value. If a donor is thinking of making a gift with an asset they own at a loss, they should sell that. That way they capture the capital loss, and then they give some or all of the resulting cash. Tangible personal property is often not understood very well by donors. They think they have something that's very valuable because it's valuable to them, but it may not have a very high price. And even so, their deduction in all likelihood, like for things like jewelry or whatever, is going to be based on the item's cost basis rather than otherwise. Sometimes, too, donors don't understand the process of making the gift. So with securities, for example, they think it's the day they call their broker or send the form in. But the gift is actually complete when the securities are received by the charitable organization, which could be a few critical days or even weeks later, depending on whether it's close to the end of the tax year or something else that's of significance in the timing of that gift. So being clear about what's involved in the process and when the gift is actually complete is important. And then as well, sometimes there are misunderstandings about how an asset is valued. Again, with publicly traded securities, some people think it's the closing price on the date of the gift, but it's actually the average between the high and low. And a lot of assets require a qualified appraisal, and that's a very formal appraisal that has to meet IRS requirements. It's not simply getting somebody's opinion as to the likely value of something that has been contributed. Charitable quests, as I say, are really just kind of the heart of planned giving. There are three basic ways to structure these. You may have different nomenclature, particularly those of you who are lawyers, but they're essentially kind of pecuniary gifts. Those are for a particular dollar amount. Gifts of specific property, so particular assets, real estate, a block of stock, whatever. And then finally, residual interest gifts, so some or all of the residue of the estate after other bequests and costs of administration and debts and all have been paid. And there are a number of ways that a bequest can be made contingent. And so you can take any of these kinds of structures and make it contingent. So the gift is made to charity only if the donor's spouse doesn't survive him or her, or other types of contingencies. And you can get fairly complex with that, and I think that's taken on greater meaning in more recent years, particularly when there was uncertainty about the estate tax, because you wanted to have a lot of possibilities for disclaimers with assets from the estate going in different directions, possibly ultimately to charity, depending on what the tax situation was when the donor died. And if a donor does, when they die, have to be concerned with estate taxes, either federal or more likely state, because of the somewhat lower threshold, there are estate tax benefits, dollar for dollar, for the charitable interest. It may be a present interest in something if it's a split benefit gift. But so those are kind of the basic things that are attractive to donors. Plus, again, these are just very easy for donors to understand and to arrange. But even with this simple, tried and true gift, sometimes things can go wrong. Quite often it's the wrong charity. Particularly a national organization that has local chapters, and that never happens to the Red Cross, I imagine, Barb?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've got to be sure about the organization, and the best way is to contact the organization ahead of time. Find out their legal name and make sure you get it right. Sometimes the donor will have a desire to change their will, but the desire is not coming from a mind that is deemed under the law to have legal capacity. So one of the good things about bequests is that they're revocable throughout the donor's life, but you have to add a caveat and say throughout the donor's life, so long as he or she has the requisite legal capacity to make testamentary dispositions, because a gift may be frozen into a will if later in life the donor doesn't have the ability to change that will. And also, it's kind of just the makes the case for checkups in a person's estate planning, because you want to have any sort of bequest or any sort of disposition on death be proportional with what the donor's overall goals are. And so sometimes you have charitable gifts that are made upon death that are either extraordinarily large compared to what the donor's objectives were by the time he or she died, or extraordinarily small. So again, you're looking to try to make sure that the nature of the bequest is in balance with other elements of the estate plan. And quite often, with bequests, unfortunately, donors try to attach restrictions or conditions that they have never discussed with the charity beforehand as to the practicality of those restrictions. And sometimes the charity will either have to decline the gift entirely or will have to work through the court or otherwise to modify those restrictions so that the gift can be taken and used for something as close as possible to what the donor has in mind. Something of a close cousin to charitable bequests are beneficiary designations, and they can be made with regard to a variety of assets, and you see here on the screen the possibilities. And to this I should add the transfer on death deed option with regard to real estate in our state that has existed here only recently. So there are many different possibilities. And beneficiary designations are great because they're very easy to arrange. It's simply a matter of filling out a beneficiary designation form usually and providing it to whoever it is that maintains the contract or the account or whatever. There are a number of other benefits in terms of probate avoidance. The gift reaches the charity relatively quickly and without the expense, to the extent it would be an expense, or delays involved in probate. But there are even some downsides associated with this popular sort of gift. And probably the biggest one is, again, people sort of doing do-it-yourself estate planning. They've made a beneficiary designation, whether it's charitable or non-charitable, but it doesn't line up with the other things that they've done or not done as part of their estate planning. And so you might have sometimes a will provision and a beneficiary designation sort of at odds with each other. So it's one more thing that makes the case for people doing coordinated estate planning with somebody who's helping them think through all of the different assets they own and all of the different objectives, charitable and non-charitable, that they have for their estate. It can also be something of a challenge to have other than a fairly straightforward disposition of the assets upon the donor's death. So if a donor has in mind some sort of restriction, it can often be more practical for that sort of restriction to be expressed in a side agreement that the donor and the charity enter into while the donor is still alive than to try to write it into the beneficiary designation that the financial institution mostly then has to honor as the distribution is being made. And there are as well sometimes some delays that you can find with financial institutions in acting on these things, even though they should be administered quickly shortly after death. Some financial institutions kind of dilly-dally around, and I had one client in the Seattle area. Most of my work is done directly for charities, and we in turn then work with their donors. But this was a donor who had died, and she had a 457 plan, and she had named the charity as the beneficiary of that upon her death. The financial institution not only made the charity open up an account with them, but then when the charity promptly liquidated everything in the account because there was no reason for it to keep the account open, the financial institution withheld 20% for taxes. I mean, this is a nonprofit tax-exempt organization. But you could not talk sense to this financial institution. The charity I was working with, the CFO was kind of blasé, but he said, it's okay. I mean, it's less unrelated business taxable income we have to pay on at the end of the year, because it was a charity that had some aspects to its operation that did generate that kind of income. But you see these problems sometimes, and they're unfortunate, because we try to encourage donors to think about this as a very easy, and as we'll see in a moment as well, tax-efficient way with regard to a lot of assets that a person might own on death. So many times beneficiary designations deal with income in respect of a decedent, assets that if the donor continued to live and draw upon, those would be taxable to the donor, and then upon the donor's death, that built up previously untaxed income carries over to whoever receives the distribution. Now the benefit of this is that when you have a distribution going to a tax-exempt organization, it pays no tax on the distribution. So it can be very tax efficient. You know, things like IRAs, to the extent the IRA has been funded with pre-tax contributions, 401k plans, things in nature, sometimes annuity contracts, savings bonds have income in respect of a decedent built up inside of them oftenly. Those can't be dealt with by beneficiary designation, but they can, in a carefully drafted will provision, be transferred to charity from the estate in a manner that does not result in the estate, which is a taxable entity, recognizing any of the income in respect of the decedent. And so basically, these are good assets for donors to give at the end of life. And they aren't really the best sort of assets for donors to draw upon during life to make gifts. Mostly what you're hoping for is a kind of even match. And it's sort of the opposite of what you find during life. Gifts of long-term appreciated capital assets are great for making charitable gifts. Upon death, they're not all that good, because those are the assets that, due to the step-up in basis, should go to family members or other people who, if they turn around and sell those assets, are going to have a less capital gains tax they're going to have to pay because of the step-up. So, again, lifetime assets, things like gifts from IRAs and all that, the best you can kind of do is hope that you get a deduction that equals the amount that has been withdrawn from whatever this IRD asset is, and then you hope as well the donor can actually claim that based on the limits to the deduction, the claiming of the deduction as a percentage of the adjusted gross income of the donor. It's better if you're going to draw on these assets. So if somebody wants to make a $10,000 gift and they want to draw upon their IRA to do it, they take a $10,000 distribution. But then when they make their charitable gift, they give what? They give long-term appreciated capital gain assets. Then they have $10,000 cash, and they can use that $10,000 to go back into the market and reestablish the same position they had in the stock or whatever, but this time it has a higher basis. And it's not a wash sale, because there's no sale involved. It's strictly a charitable giving arrangement. There was, and maybe again, the so-called IRA charitable rollover, but that has a lot of limitations to it. It applies only to donors who are age 70 and a half at the time of the gift, not in the year of the gift. So if you have somebody in a year when the rollover is possible and they don't turn 70 and a half till July, but they make their rollover gift in April, that's too soon. They have to be at least 70 and a half. There's an upward limit to these, $100,000 a year, and they can be done, by the way, only from traditional IRAs as opposed to SEPs or simple IRAs. And also from Roth IRAs. You sort of say, well, why would somebody do that from a Roth IRA? Because all the distribution is tax exempt to begin with. But sometimes there are penalties with regard to money that's in a Roth that has not been in there at least 5 years. The gifts can be made only to public charities, and even if they are made to a public charity, they cannot be for the use of a donor advised fund. And the gift opportunities that exist are strictly direct cash transfers from the IRA to charity. It's not possible to do any other type of planned gift with those, and there's no sense in doing an in-kind distribution. The good thing is that they help, to the extent the donor hasn't used it already, they count against the donor's required minimum distribution for the year, because again, that's the thing about the donor being 70 and a half. He or she is, by definition, old enough that required minimum distributions are going to be relevant. So this is currently not the law. There are bills in both houses of Congress that have passed those houses, but they have not been sent to the other chamber. And it's a possibility that maybe in November this will be reenacted retroactively for like the third or fourth time. This was an element that first came into the plan giving quiver of arrows in 2006 with the Pension Protection Act, but it's always had a two-year limit to it. And every time it's been reenacted retroactively, and it creates a lot of confusion for donors. It'd be nice if they just made it permanent, but we shall see. So now to some of the somewhat more complex charitable giving arrangements, and we're about halfway through. So let me pause and see if anybody has any questions. You've been a good, attentive group, but I got a little time. Yes?
There was one slide back about six slides or so that had an asterisk next to the charitable remainder trust. I was just wondering what that asterisk meant. It was the only item that had the only item that had the asterisk. There it is right there.
Okay. Charitable remainder trusts. They are irrevocable in the sense that the trust as an entity cannot be revoked. But a donor can, if they do so up front, retain the power over time to change the charitable beneficiary. So these are not necessarily gifts that a charity can book, if you will, unless they are a vested remainder beneficiary, unless the donor, as to the gift to that charity, no longer has a power to change it. So thank you. That's a good eagle eye catch there. So charitable gift annuities. This is basically a contract between a donor and a charitable organization. You can have one or two people to whom the annuity payments are made, an annuity, a fixed amount of life that the organization pays. Usually the payments are to the donor or to the donors if it's husband and wife or some other contributors of joint property. But sometimes people set these things up for other people or for themselves and one other person. They are usually funded with cash or long-term capital gain marketable securities. I sometimes see them funded, however, with real estate and other more esoteric assets. The rates are fairly attractive, and the rates that almost all charities in the United States follow are those that are suggested by an organization called the American Council on Gift Annuities. It's a voluntary thing, but the thought is it's in the spirit of charities not necessarily to compete on the rates that they offer, but rather to compete on mission. So if you're considering a charitable gift annuity with three different organizations, chances are that all three of those will offer you the same rate based on whatever your age is. And as you might imagine, the older the annuitant is, the larger the rate that is paid. But you have three distinct organizations you want to benefit. And so essentially you're asked as the donor, well, which mission is it that I want to support? Given that the charitable and financial aspects or the financial and tax aspects are going to be the same from one charity to another. Some charities will actually offer lower rates than those suggested by the American Council on Gift Annuities. That's helpful because it means there's more available for charitable purposes, and it also, as you might expect, results in a somewhat higher charitable deduction. But generally, charities adhere to those rates fairly uniformly. Payments can be made immediately, although they can also be deferred. So immediate payment gift annuities appeal to a charity's older supporters, typically those in their 70s or 80s. Deferred annuities, although they can be realistic with shorter deferral periods for older donors, are more popular with people who might be in their 40s or 50s or 60s. There is a deduction for part of the value of what's used to fund the gift annuity, but it makes sense that it's not the entire amount because there's a payment stream that's non-charitable that's flowing from that arrangement. And there's favorable taxation of the payments, but that's not because it's a charitable gift annuity, because you find favorable taxation of payments in commercial annuities where it has been annuitized, where the payments are made over life expectancy. But that, combined with the deduction and capital gains tax avoidance to some extent, makes up a total package of benefits with charitable gift annuities that can be, you know, really quite appealing. And there is an interplay to some extent between charitable gift annuities and commercial annuities. For one thing, gift annuity rates are consciously set to be distinguishably lower than commercial annuity rates so that charities don't confuse donors or others by thinking that they're strictly in the business of paying annuities. So there's an emphasis on the charitable element of the arrangement that is part of the reason that the rates are lower. And they're regulated entities too. I apparently skipped over a slide, sorry about that. Anyway, or I've gone ahead in my slides, but yes. Anyway, they are regulated by the state of Washington, and in some other states, New York, California in particular, heavily regulate gift annuities. Others are not, don't regulate them at all, and you find sort of anything along a spectrum. So that means if you have a Washington donor, the organization to which he or she would make a gift annuity contribution has to be permitted by the Office of the Insurance Commissioner in our state to issue those annuities. Otherwise, the charity is asking for some potentially serious fines in so doing. So as you represent your clients, if they are interested in a charitable gift annuity, kind of the number one thing is to make sure that the organization that the donor wants to support is properly authorized to issue them in our state. The payment options with regard to charitable gift annuities are kind of vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. You can have immediate annuities, you can have deferred annuities, and then there's some things you can do with deferred annuities that are a little bit different. You can have a so-called commuted payment gift annuity, where in effect it's a gift annuity for a term of years rather than for the lifetime or lifetimes of one or two annuitants. You can also have a flexible deferred annuity so that the payments begin at any point during a range of years, and the annuitant later in life chooses when particularly the payments are to begin. A standard deferred annuity, the donor makes that decision right up front. talked about the payment options. Again, that commercial annuities, by contrast, have any number of ways that they can be structured and all kinds of variations on them. The annuity rates, as I mentioned, are lower with gift annuities than with commercial annuities. And there are some options that a charity has when it issues a gift annuity. It can do what's called reinsuring. It's not reinsurance in the classic sense, but essentially the charity enters into the annuity obligation, commits to it contractually, but then it takes a portion of the donor's contribution and it purchases a commercial annuity, essentially to secure the cash flow that will be necessary to meet the payment obligation that it's undertaken. And because there's a differential between gift annuity rates and commercial rates, it means that the charity will always be paying less to the commercial insurance company to buy that cash flow. And so some of the contribution will be available possibly for use currently by the charity rather than simply at the end of the life or lives when the payment obligation has ended. Now, these two can have problems, as wonderful as they can be, and you know, we're seeing this again. Sometimes donors will enter into gift annuity arrangements and they won't tell their estate planners or any of their advisors. Again, the contracts are fairly simple and they're approved by the state of Washington. So the contract review is not going to be extensive. It's about a 1.5-page document. But the implications for a gift annuity, particularly a relatively large one, can be significant in the donor's estate. And sometimes they just sort of often do these things by themselves without checking with their advisors, and that can be risky. Sometimes donors are more attracted to these by the financial element than they are by the gift element. As a general rule, that can be a drawback with almost any kind of planned gift. Even though the tax benefits can be appealing, enticing, whatever, they shouldn't be the primary reason for doing it. They should help be kind of the frosting on the cake, the thing that helps make the gift more affordable. But the donor has to have a basic, relatively strong charitable impulse in the first place, or there's going to be, in all likelihood, some donor's remorse. And there are dangers for the charity, too. It can find that the contribution is entirely exhausted, and yet the annuitant or annuitants are still living. So then the charity has to use unrestricted assets to continue fulfilling that payment obligation. So the charity might end up losing money on the arrangement. This does happen even with the biggest of gift annuity programs, but it doesn't happen that often, as long as the charity is following good practices. And what happens far less is that the charity actually defaults on payments. There really hasn't been any indication of that, other than charities that were sort of shams to begin with, and they were issuing gift annuities kind of as a pyramid scheme type thing. Now, charitable remainder trusts that a lot of you may be familiar with, they come in two different basic kinds. They pay either an annuity or a unit trust amount, a fixed percentage of the value of the trust's assets, as that changes from time to time. There are various conditions that have to be met, so complying with private foundation rules. Also, the payout rate has to be a certain minimum amount. It can only be a certain maximum amount. Combined with the term of the trust, it has to result in the present value of the charitable interest being at least 10% of what goes into the trust. But those conditions are fairly easy to meet in the typical donor situation. They are usually funded with long-term capital gain assets. Quite often see real estate, publicly traded securities, but it can be other types of assets as well, although not S corporation stock. That blows the tax-exempt nature of the charitable remainder trust, whereas S stock can be given to an operating charity. The charity has tax considerations that it has if it decides it wants to accept that, but with a charitable remainder trust, it's sort of deadly. But we sometimes see these funded with cash, either entirely or at least partially. With a charitable remainder annuity trust, only one contribution can be made. That's the one at the beginning. So only one funding opportunity. With unit trusts, you can not only fund it initially, but over time as well if the donor wants to add to it. There is, again, a deduction for part of the value of what goes into the trust because the arrangement is partly charitable, partly non-charitable. And the taxation of the payments is a function of the nature and the extent of the income that's earned by the trust from year to year. And trust accounting, charitable remainder trust accounting, can be relatively complex because there are different tiers or categories of income that are distributed over time depending upon the activities of the trust. Whereas with the gift annuity, you know to the penny how every payment is going to be made, both during the balance of the donor's life or the annuitant's life expectancy and beyond. So some more things about charitable remainder trusts. You can structure a unit trust so that, in effect, there's little or even nothing paid for a period of years. And then at some later point, the trust is able to make payments. It's a function of the way the trust is structured and the nature of the investments that are held by the trust. There are a lot of issues with regard to picking an appropriate trustee. And unfortunately, I see a lot of problems with donors who serve as their own trustees. They mess up the accounting. They don't realize they have to file tax returns on behalf of the trust. So even though the trust is a tax-exempt entity, it has to prove that to the IRS essentially every year, the way a public charity does with a 990 return. Charitable remainder trusts have their own tax returns, and those sometimes just don't happen. Or the investment is handled poorly, or payments aren't made. So there are all kinds of horror stories. So I would counsel you to make sure that your donors, your clients, work with trustees who understand charitable remainder trusts and are going to do a good job. And you want to look certainly at what the trustee fees are and how those are, you know, how competitive they are and the sort of continuity that can be provided as well. Because you may have a donor who's very good at serving as their own trustee for the first 10 or 15 years of their lives. But they get into their late 80s and they're still the trustee and they shouldn't be anymore. So successor trusteeship is another important consideration. And then finally, even though most of the focus with charitable remainder trusts is on so-called qualified ones, ones that meet a number of conditions so that they are tax exempt and so that the contributions to them qualify for charitable deductions, whether income tax deductions or gift or estate tax deductions, there is a realm increasingly of non-qualified charitable remainder trusts. And I gave a talk over in Portland earlier this year on behalf of the OHSU Foundation, whole hour on non-qualified trusts. So there are a lot of planning opportunities here, I think, that have opened up, especially because the transfer tax thresholds are now much higher than they used to be. Unfortunately, as popular charitable remainder trusts are, things can go wrong with them. And one of the bigger problems we saw, particularly 10 or 15, 20 years ago, is that people were picking payout rates that were too high. They were unsustainable. They established these trusts during the mid to late 90s when the stock market was mostly just going like that. But we've seen over time that that's not always the case. And so in some cases, the worst of the cases where you have an annuity amount that's paid by the trust and you have a declining trust corpus, that trust can run out of assets while the beneficiaries are still alive, while the trust still has an obligation. And at that point, there is nothing left to make the payments with. So there is less security for a donor with a CRAT than there is with a gift annuity, because at least with a gift annuity, the charity stands behind the payments. The most you might have in the way of recourse with a CRAT that's crashed is maybe a cause of action against the trustee if they didn't manage it, if you can make that case, I guess I would say. And sometimes you see the inappropriate structure. So particularly with unit trusts, there are many different sub-structures in the unit trust realm. And sometimes the donor doesn't understand their options well enough and picks the wrong option, and it doesn't suit them well over time. The trust either is not funded with the right assets to begin with, or over time it doesn't make good investment decisions. So it might invest in municipal bonds, tax-free income, great. But it's very hard to reach that tier of income, because before that tier you have ordinary income and capital gain. And in almost all cases, that's what the payments are going to consist of. Also, there have been some difficulties over time with funding them with annuity contracts. It seemed like a great idea, but in practice it has not worked out well. A lot of times donors, particularly if they're own trustee, they don't understand the intricacies of how the payments from the trust are taxed. We talked about problems of trustees in general who are not up to the task. Trusts can be funded with too little to begin with, like $50,000 or $75,000. I think about $100,000 is the least that's practical. And it, again, depends on the fee structure of the trustee, among a number of other things, as well as how long the trust is going to last. And recently, since I think about 2007, again, because of the Pension Protection Act, I believe, there's been a greater ability for the public to have access to records on charitable remainder trusts that the IRS maintains, particularly the name of the trust. And sometimes you find the donor has named the trust after him or herself. Well, that can be an indication of wealth for companies that mine IRS records looking for indications of wealth. So the better practice these days is to pick an obscure name for the charitable remainder trust so that nobody can decipher it and figure out who the donor is, and then send them some direct mail. Charitable lead trusts are the flip of charitable remainder trusts. So during the trust's existence, payments are made to one or more charities, and then when the trust ends, what remains is distributed to one or more people. There are two basic types, once again, annuity trusts and unit trusts. These are not tax-exempt trusts, although they do have to comply with various tax requirements, such as observing the private foundation rules and carefully being aware of the tax consequences of the trust. There are mostly these are set up for transfer tax purposes, which means they are of appeal to only the wealthiest of donors. But increasingly, I'm finding donors who, for income tax purposes, are setting these up. And it's part of the general trend that you're finding in estate planning overall in the last few years since the higher transfer tax federal limits were established, that estate planning, from a tax point of view, is more and more about income tax planning, either during the balance of the donor's life or upon death, than it is so much about transfer tax. So I'm working with a donor now who is going to establish a $1 million lifetime charitable lead annuity trust. It's going to be made a grantor trust because this donor wants the income tax deduction. Upon the donor's death, 90% of his estate is going to go to charity anyway, so he doesn't have an estate or gift tax problem. He's got an income tax problem that he's trying to deal with this way. And this is a way to kind of leverage the gifts to charity, sometimes in a way that helps to sort of skirt the percentage of adjusted gross income limits that a truly charitable, very generous donor is going to have to be concerned with beyond a point. And particularly now, charitable lead annuity trusts, because annuity payment streams are very sensitive to a discount rate, continue to be possible. It is relatively easy still to sort of zero out these trusts so that the present value of the charitable interest is deemed to be 100% of the assets that go into the trust. So the present value of the non-charitable interest is zero. And you can approach zero with a unit trust, but with an annuity trust, you can actually zero things out, depending on how long the trust lasts and what its payout rate is. Now, the problems. Quite often people will they'll think of these like CRTs. Oh, I'm going to fund it with a lot of highly appreciated capital gain assets. The trust is going to sell those assets. Well, there's the problem. Taxable trust. It's either taxable to the donor, because it's a grantor trust, or the trust itself is taxable. And so you're looking for assets that, to the extent they do generate any kind of income, whether it's capital gain or ordinary income, that's pretty well matched up with what the payout rate from the trust is, so that you don't have a lot of income that's going out that is going to be subject to a tax. Now again, with a grantor trust, because that income is all taxed to the donor anyway, they got their income tax benefit up front. Each year thereafter, they're taxable on the trust's income. So once again, you have to be these things are very tax sensitive. Probably the best asset to put into a charitable deed trust is an apartment building that generates enough rent to make the payments to charity each year, and yet holds its value and possibly even increases its value, so that 10 or 15 or 20 years later, when the trust ends, it still owns the apartment building, and then that's distributed to the donor's heirs, who get it with a much greater value and possibly even no transfer tax. The downside is that those assets, when they're distributed, carry over the trust's basis, and if it was the funding asset to begin with, then it carries over effectively the donor's basis, which means there could be a lot of capital gain upon distribution and sale of that asset. And again, sometimes donors just don't understand the pros and cons of various payout rates or trust durations, and so there's a little bit of art and science, and sometimes you just need to play around with the deductions. And with software made by my company and others, you can do that very quickly and settle on some scenarios that make sense. There's a possibility of structuring a grat so that it can be a charitable vehicle for a donor. This is basically a non-charitable vehicle, grantor retained annuity trust. It's set up for a lot of the same transfer tax purposes that you might find a charitable deed trust to be set up for, except in this instance, what you have is a donor who's charitable enough that they might take some portion of what the grat pays them each year and use that to make charitable gifts. Or they can take their payment as a distribution in kind from the grat and transfer that in kind to the charity. That is a way to get a little more mileage out of that. There is a paper I prepared, and it has some examples of a lot of the types of gift arrangements that I've been talking about, and there's a good thing about the details of a so-called charitable grat in there as well. A few other miscellaneous kinds of things that you will occasionally run into, they're not especially common. Retained life estate arrangements, these apply to a personal residence. It doesn't have to be the donor's principal residence, so it could be a vacation property or a farm, although it's not things on the farm, so not the crops or the cattle or the barn, well, farm equipment. It can be structures on the property, but usually you see them with personal residence. The donor deeds it to charity but retains the ability to live there for life or a term of years, possibly reserving that estate for one or more people other than the donor. And you see that sometimes in a donor's will, they make a bequest to charity, but a life estate is reserved for somebody who survives the donor. Again, there's a deduction for part of the value of what goes into the trust, or rather what the value of the property, but not all of it. The lower the discount rate, the greater the deduction. Also, the older the life tenant is, and or the shorter the period of years, if it's a term of years arrangement, the higher the deduction is. So right now, you sometimes find with donors in their 80s giving their personal residence, they might get a deduction for about 80% of the fair market value of that property. Some of it depends on how much of the property is land and how much is improvements, but there again, you can play with the figures pretty readily. And if the donor later needs to move out because they need nursing care or they just don't want the upkeep of a house, at that point, the property can be sold with the charity and the donor or life tenant, whoever it is, dividing the proceeds based on their respective actuarial interests. Or the donor can rent the property out, although it would be a strange sort of tenancy if you know you can live somewhere only as long as your landlord is alive. The donor, if they can afford to do so, and if they're charitable enough, they can give that life estate to the charity, and then the charity owns the whole property. They own the remainder interest to begin with. When that's matched up with the life estate, it owns all interests, and so it can sell or use the property. And also, the life estate can be given for a gift annuity, and you can even give the remainder interest for a gift annuity. From a charity's point of view, that has to pencil out, and there are a lot of concerns in terms of what you keep in the reserve account that's mandated by the Washington OIC, but you can pair a retained life estate with a gift annuity. There are some challenges with these too. You often have charities regret these because they have donors who over time grow less scrupulous about how they maintain the place, and it can be a real mess by the time the donor dies. One good way to deal with this is with some sort of upfront agreement. So even though the gift itself is very easily made with just a deed from the donor to the charity, you want to have a side agreement that's kind of in the nature of a lease or a co-ownership arrangement as to how expenses dealing with the property are to be handled and decisions are to be made. Charitable bargain sales. A bargain sale is kind of like it sounds. It's a sale to charity, but a bargain price, something less than what the asset is worth. And so the difference between the sale price and the value is a tax deduction. And also, with a bargain sale, you have a proration of capital gain. It's essentially a proration of the basis between the sale element and the gift element. And so there's some capital gain that's recognized by the donor, but not all of it. Interestingly, a charitable gift annuity, when it's funded with long-term capital gain assets, is a form of bargain sale, even when it's funded with cash. But when it's funded with long-term capital gain assets, some of the capital gain is never taxed. It's deemed to be recognized by the charity. The rest of the gain that is taxed is spread over the life expectancy of the annuitant, so long as the annuitant is the owner of that property. So you have these most always with real estate. I mean, in theory, you can do a bargain sale with publicly traded securities, but then you might as well just sell some of them on the open market and transfer the other ones to charity. It's the same from a tax point of view. And usually, moreover, it's done with regard to real estate that the charity wants to acquire for its own use. And it approaches the donor, and the donor can't afford to make a gift, but is also inclined, by virtue of the charity's mission, not necessarily to hold out for market value. So some price in between is settled upon. And even though bargain sales usually result in immediate payments, it is possible to structure them so that payments are made over a period of time. The main thing that goes wrong is that there's a mismatch between the amount of gain that's recognized and the deduction that would be available to offset that gain. This is an entirely avoidable problem. You just spend time with the calculations, making sure that the bargain sale price is suitable, and looking at the donor's tax situation, that they can take advantage of the deduction to the maximum extent possible, again, based on their AGI limits. So just a few more things. Life insurance can be used to make charitable gifts. Those of you who are life insurance agents, this is a very simplistic overview of the types of policies that are out there. But there are many different ways that policies can be used to make gifts. As long as it's a policy the donor can actually own, as opposed to, you know, a group term policy that they might have through an employer, the donor can make direct transfers of the policy to charity, whether premiums are owed or not, or even if it's a brand new policy. And the charity, once it owns it, depending on whether premiums need to be paid, it generally relies on the donor to make those payments. But if the donor stops or is not inclined to, the charity can decide if it wants to use some of its own assets to keep the policy in force. Probably a good decision if the insured is 84. Probably not a good decision if the insured is 48. So there are pros and cons with that. And the charity can also, if it needs to, cash in the policy because it's the absolute owner of it, or it can approach the insurance company about getting a paid-up policy, albeit with a smaller death benefit amount. Quite often, however, though, life insurance policies are used to make gifts where the donor retains it, but names the charity as the beneficiary as to some or all of the death benefit. So that's a revocable gift. Donor doesn't get any income tax benefits for it, but there are estate tax benefits upon death if the donor's estate needs to be worried about it. And sometimes there are ways that you can pair, kind of arbitrage an annuity contract with a life insurance policy so that there's a positive cash flow for the donor, but that's kind of esoteric and difficult to make happen in real life, which is where I try to live as much as I can. I should say, I feel like I'm in a memorial service here with this arrangement up here, but I appreciate you. The deceased is almost interred. We have just another minute or two. There are problems with life insurance as well. So here are just kind of a quick few descriptions. And, you know, one of the uses of life insurance is a so-called wealth replacement. So a donor makes a charitable gift, but that's money that the donor's heirs aren't going to inherit. It can create family friction. And so life insurance can be a way to replace that wealth, albeit at the end of the donor's life. But if you're looking for what to replace, it sort of depends. We say, well, what would happen to that asset if the donor didn't make the gift and continue to own it? Is this an estate that's going to increase in value over time? Is it going to decrease? And so the amount of the insurance coverage needs to be paired with a fairly sophisticated analysis saying, well, to what extent are we trying to replace wealth and what is going to happen to that over time? And the very last thing I want to make you aware of is that it's possible to take existing charitable remainder trusts, as well as gift annuities and other split benefit arrangements, and terminate them now. So even though they're irrevocable, whoever the beneficiary of the payment interest is has a property interest that he or she can contribute or cash out. There are complexities associated with this. There are a number of good descriptions in the materials that I prepared as an outline by way of examples and numbers and things all of that. But for the last decade or so, my colleagues and I have been very involved in helping to terminate charitable remainder trusts where the income beneficiary either gets the cash value of their present value of their payment interest, or they contribute that interest to the charitable remainder beneficiary so that the trust in either event terminates, and if it's a charitable termination, the charity gets all of what remains in the trust. But there are ways you can use a charitable remainder trust to create a gift annuity and lots of mixing and matching. So I appreciate your patience with this. I think I have really covered the range of what's possible. The outline I prepared is a helpful thing in terms of actual numbers and realistic scenarios and things like that. There's one scenario where I noticed I quoted out-of-date tax rates. I'm sorry about that. And I also had to do these materials last month. But fortunately, the discount rate this month is the same as it was last month. So not too much has changed. But thanks for your attention. I'll be pleased to stay if there are any questions. But we are at the end of our time.
Thank you, Bill. And so I just want to remind you all to fill out your evaluation if you want to. There's some at the entry, and also there's some on that page. If you want to go ahead and fill one of these out, let us know how we're doing. And suggestions, and just a reminder for the Peace Health that we've got the Kearney Breast Center's 5th anniversary next Tuesday night. It starts at 5 o'clock and the presentation is at 5:30 next Tuesday. So these are on the table over there. So if you want to go to this event, that would be wonderful for Peace Health. Thank you very much for joining us.